camfm.co.uk.
Hello, a very warm welcome to CamFM Trending. This is the podcast from CamFM, Cambridge University and Anglia Ruskin University's student radio station, which puts together all our interviews, features and conversations in one easy-to-access place. Today, a feature we ran just towards the end of November, about Cambridge's commemoration of the Holodomor, particularly the importance of the community group Cambridge for Ukraine, whose chair, Andrew Smith-Sniuk, I'll be speaking to. Now, the Holodomor was a man-made famine which killed millions, and which many countries, including the UK and the EU, consider an intentional genocide. It took place in Ukraine in 1932 and 1933, and the world might not have known about it were it not for the work of a Welsh journalist who studied at Cambridge called Gareth Jones. So to mark this year's Holodomor Memorial Day, which always falls on the fourth Saturday of November, Cambridge for Ukraine, the community group, held a candle-making workshop and a screening of the 2019 film Mr. Jones, which is about Gareth Jones's extraordinary life. I sat down with the chair of Cambridge for Ukraine, Andrew Smith-Sniuk, a little earlier, towards the end of November, to talk about the Holodomor, Cambridge's Ukrainian community, and plenty more besides in an interview which first went out on CamFM News Brunch. I started by asking Andrew to explain, in his own words, what that event they were commemorating, the Holodomor, was.
First of all, thank you so much for having me, Aaron. And thank you for this question. I think it is very important to explain what it actually is. This is something that is seen in Ukraine, but also in most countries of the world as genocidal extermination of Ukrainians by hunger due to collectivization of the farms in Ukraine, Soviet Union. But also many actions that accompanied it, such as execution of Ukrainian-speaking authors Soviet attempt to destroy Ukrainian culture as such.
Mm, yes, and this was in the 1930s under Stalin, just to say. So you commemorated this event with a screening of a film called Mr. Jones, which I was really interested by. Can you just tell us who Mr. Jones is and what his role in relation to the Holodomor is?
Well, Mr. Jones is this, I think, personally find it him to be a very fascinating figure because he is a journalist. He is someone who graduated from the University of Cambridge in degree in foreign languages. And I find it interesting because I teach and study foreign languages myself. And he is someone who interviewed Hitler before World War II and then traveled to Soviet Union in attempt to interview Stalin. But what he did was even more important. He actually traveled and took a self-sanctioned trip to east of Ukraine, and he witnessed the result of collectivization, and he saw people starving, and he wrote about it after leaving the Soviet Union. And what is the worst of all, what is really tragic, that he was labeled a liar because there was a journalist in Moscow whose career really depended on Russian propaganda of the time, who said that this is not true. And now looking at it, we can see that he indeed was speaking the truth and he indeed did the right thing. Mr. Jones, Gareth Jones.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I mean, it would have been considerable personal risk at the time, I suppose, to leave Moscow and go to Ukraine without, without Stalin's permission.
I think it was almost impossible to do something like this. So it does require a degree of bravery. And I think this is something that also would not have been impossible. That would not have been possible without speaking languages, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was also very, very useful. So it was a huge risk that paid off, I think. And I think it's a really, really fascinating story. And another part of his story is actually his mother's story, which is not featured in the film, but she was, in fact, a tutor to children of one John Hughes, who is actually a founder of Donetsk, and it's a testimony to the strong British involvement in Donbass, specifically in industrialization of Donbass. And this part of history has been erased during the Soviet times, and now it is there are attempts to erase it by Russian propaganda right now, which claims that the Donbass has always been Russian. But what Ukrainians are trying to do now to revive this story history of very strong European presence in Donbass. And now we know that this region, which is so much destroyed now, has been flourishing in the beginning of 20th century, the end of 19th century, and it had very strong presence of British engineers there, in fact.
Interesting. Yeah, of course, Donbass really at the center of the current conflict going on in Ukraine. Yeah, as part of this Holodomor commemoration as well on Saturday, I understand you had a candle making workshop. Do you think, as since the full scale invasion in 2022, do you think it's taken on even more significance commemorating this Holodomor? Do you think it's got a new resonance now?
I think so. I think it's tragic to see these parallels, right? If we look at Bucha or Irpin or other sites of mass murder, we can also see some hatred towards everything Ukrainian, yeah. And if you do listen to some of the speeches by Russian politicians, or the speech that preceded this invasion, essentially it says, "Oh, Ukrainian doesn't exist. Ukraine is not a country. Ukrainian language is not a language." And to some degree, these narratives were also present in 32, 33. And I wanted to dedicate this screening actually to the memory of a friend of mine who was killed actually in this war on November 11th. So I think it was almost 2 weeks before the screening. And that is really tragic. What was also tragic is that one of the co-organizers, her name is Irina. She has a family history of Holodomor, so her grandmother and grandfather both survived through it, and her grandmother was actually one of two children to survive out of a family of eight children. And so I think for her it was also a very, very personal story, and it makes it more tragic in many ways. Also, I think that the story of Gareth Jones makes it more inspiring in this sense. Yeah, this is a journalist who did tell the truth and was labeled a liar back in the day, and now we do know what has happened. So now some sort of justice is served, and I think this is something that many Ukrainians, myself included, are looking for. Seeing how much injustice there is happening, one really wants to believe in possibility of it being served at least at some point.
Yeah, of course, intensely, yeah, personal story there. I'm so sorry to hear about your friend. Do you think out of this, out of the current full-scale invasion, at least, there is a better kind of awareness and sort of understanding of Ukrainian culture in the UK now?
I think there is, first of all, more understanding of Holodomor in many countries of the world. I think UK included recognized it officially as genocide, right? And I think that is important. But also there is much higher awareness of Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian language. So my specific role is, I am an instructor of Ukrainian language. I'm teaching Ukrainian language, and our numbers in university where I'm teaching are skyrocketing. So we have more people studying Ukrainian now than ever before. And what I'm personally very happy about, we have more people than we had in 22, 23, or 23, 24. So it shows that even if Ukraine is not in the news as much, still the interest is there. And Ukraine has so much to offer in terms of culture. I always suggest to my students to take a look at Ukrainian contemporary music, like Alyona, who is this phenomenal hip hop artist that really covers actually some of the topics that we discussed. But I think more importantly, someone who presents Ukrainian culture in a very interesting way.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the development of Ukrainian and MML Slavonic. Do you think that's meant there's been a bit of a center of gravity shift in Slavonic studies generally? An old criticism of Slavonic studies in the past would be it's maybe a bit Russia-centric at the expense of, say, Ukraine, Poland, other countries.
I do agree with that criticism. I think in many instances, Slavonic studies in many places is actually Russian studies and maybe something else. I think we are lucky here to have Ukrainian studies for a continuous period of time. So the university in Cambridge actually has had Ukrainian since 2006, but then a broader program was developed in 2010. It has developed and has continued, and so that shifted the focus somewhat, but I think that that's not enough, unfortunately. And I think that what also has to be more studied is actually the history of Poland and Polish people in the United Kingdom. So many of these Slavonic studies departments across the UK do cover Russian, but often they don't cover Polish, despite it being one of the most used foreign languages in the United Kingdom. So I think it's really the time to sort of bring more balance in Slavonic studies.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Actually, I'm Norman Davis, the historian of Poland, was speaking in Cambridge recently and did make that exact point. In fact, the only tenured position in Polish studies is here in Cambridge. Really, really interesting discussion to be had there as well. But we'll turn to one of your many other hats that you wear and talk about the fact that you're the chair of Cambridge for Ukraine, the group here. In Cambridge, helping the Ukrainian community. Could you just talk a little bit about what Cambridge for Ukraine does, what its kind of raison d'être is?
Cambridge for Ukraine is an organization that was created primarily by students, but also lecturers who were members of the Cambridge University Ukrainian Society. And the reason for this organization was that an organization could do much more than essentially a student society could. And what we did focus on was help to displaced Ukrainians. Yeah, in early days of the full-scale invasion, we would send calls to host Ukrainians. The UK government opened a scheme that allowed many Ukrainians to come to the UK, but only under condition that they have to be, named by someone who has residence in the UK. So they have to be hosted by someone, and these hosts were, the term was sponsors. So what we're trying to do, we were trying to find sponsors here and introduce them to people in Ukraine who needed help. But also we would run a lot of projects for Ukrainian children, because for them it was a very difficult moment, I would say, to socialize and to integrate into society here. Many struggled with getting into British schools, and we would run this Saturday Ukrainian school project, so they could get to know other children and parents could meet other parents, and we would provide a lot of consulting, but also very basic help in terms of groceries or other things in the very beginning. And now the focus has shifted to community building. In other ways, we provide for many Ukrainians a platform to organize some of these events. And in fact, most of the decision-making members actually within organizations, so those who sort of work on day-to-day activities, are displaced Ukrainians themselves that really wanted to tell their own story and speak about Ukraine to the broader Cambridge audience. So I would love to invite everyone to come to our events. In fact, we will be hosting something actually next week on the 5th of December. We will be featuring actually a group of kobzars, and kobzars are those Ukrainian bards that play this very traditional musical instrument that was really key to this Cossack era in Ukraine. They will be performing at 5:30 p.m. at Downing Place United Reformed Church, where we typically hold all of our events.
Yeah. A huge range of cultural events that are put on by Cambridge for Ukraine. A lot of film, I notice, and also interestingly for Ukrainian independence this day this year, kind of a focus on food as well, on borscht. What do you think the role of kind of food culture is in Ukraine?
Well, I think that food in Ukraine is something that is very, very essential to the family. I think that a lot of discussions, a lot of family happenings, happen over some very traditional food. And I think many people, when they do come here, when they travel from Ukraine to the UK, they sort of miss that part of their daily life. And I do miss it too as well. And it is used as a sort of this cultural diplomacy, right? And borscht, the Ukrainian beetroot soup, is one of the main pillars of this cultural diplomacy. In fact, there is a restaurant in Cambridge called Borscht. It's on Parker's Piece, but I think it's only open typically during the summer. And it is another success story of this Ukrainian woman leaving everything behind, coming to Cambridge, struggling to find her role in here, and then opening this mini restaurant to serve borscht to whoever is actually willing to come and eat it. And I think this is very inspiring. And food is something that also internationally, yes, you don't need to speak Ukrainian to eat borscht, right? And this is for many people who do get involved in organizing these events. It's sort of their way to speak for about Ukraine and speak for their culture when they're still learning English.
Yeah. From personal experience, I can say borscht is an excellent export. Do you think we were talking about all the Ukrainians arriving in Cambridge around 2022 after the full-scale invasion? Do you think the Ukrainian community has changed since 2022? Obviously, it's bigger. Has it changed in nature?
I think that essentially everything changes, right? And Ukrainian community did change as well. First of all, then the questions and the issues brought up by those who came here are very different. In 2022, a lot of them really wondered how to get very basic things done and where to live and what to do, how to find work. And now it's more complex issues of trying to navigate their lives here, but also trying to connect with other people, trying to integrate into society, which sometimes can be difficult. I speak perfect English, but it took me some time to really integrate into British society, if I can say that. I think that also what is very inspiring is that many of those people who came here, and left everything behind and did not know what they can even do, try to volunteer and to run many initiatives to help others and to, raise funds and send them to Ukraine and provide some assistance to those who are in Ukraine. Which is this very, very inspiring story, because I think many see them struggling, But they do, even though they do struggle, they try to focus on helping others as well. And I find it to be very, very inspiring. So many have been running all different kinds of events, initiatives, and trying to help those who are now in Ukraine.
That's fantastic. Obviously, it's a very tense and kind of uncertain geopolitical situation at the moment, particularly since the re-election to the White House of Donald Trump. Is there optimism at the moment? Is there pessimism, or is that too simplistic?
I mean, I think that generally the feeling that I get from many Ukrainians is pessimism to a degree. So I think that there was some degree of predictability with the current US president. And many feel that it might be unpredictable with the new president coming into the White House. And it's so clearly that Ukrainian authorities will have to work with the new government, new administration. But I think the feeling is that they are hesitating themselves to what the best approach will be. And I think that certainly there will be some push for peace. And in Ukraine, or Ukrainians who are living in Cambridge, what they're most scared of that this will be just a very superficial peace that will not last very long, and that if Ukraine sacrifices a lot of its territories and leaves many people, many Ukrainians actually living under Russian occupation, that might only encourage further invasion. So I think that the Ukrainians who I know here, they feel very hesitant and unsure about what the future brings.
Yes, of course. There was a peace of sorts, I suppose, after the 2014 invasion of Crimea. So obviously parallels there. So you've got this event coming up on December the 5th. Anything else we can look forward to? Where's Cambridge for Ukraine going next?
I think that the next thing that we'll be working on would be Christmas fair on 14th of December, and you can get more information about that from our socials. We run an Instagram page and Facebook page, which is Cambridge for Ukraine. So Cambridge, then number four, and then Ukraine all together. And we try to cooperate with other academic institutions to really have something that would, fit different audiences and will help, people learn about Ukraine in many different aspects. So we'll be very happy to see anyone in our events or anyone joining and bringing any new ideas to us if they want to get more involved with Ukrainian culture and meeting the Ukrainian community.
Yeah, so important to say these aren't just events for the Ukrainian community. It's much broader than that as well. It's for anyone in Cambridge or beyond. Andrew, thanks so much for taking some time today. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much, Aaron. It's my pleasure.
Cam FM.
My huge thanks to Andrew for coming on Cam FM and speaking to us about the Holodomor and Cambridge for Ukraine more broadly there. Obviously, all year round, there's plenty to get involved with at Cambridge for Ukraine. You can find them online at cambridgeforukraine.uk, and they're also on all the usual social media you'd expect. Cambridge for Ukraine, that's the number four in the middle there. If you like this interview, there's plenty more at camfm.co.uk or in this very podcast feed. But for now, I really appreciate you tuning in. Thanks so much. Do, if you'd like, leave us a review or give us a follow. We always really appreciate that. But I've been Aaron Siposh, and I'm wishing you on, as I'm recording this on the 23rd of December, a peaceful and safe and joyous Christmas and end to the year.